everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy, and I host the show. And today I have a great guest on. We're going to kind of pick his brain a little bit, find out all about him. His name is Swami Kriyananda. So welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, Swami, you're a teacher of meditation and yoga to thousands of people, author of over 90 books, and composer of more than 400 songs, and founder of 7 communities worldwide. It sounds like you've had a very busy life.
Well, I've had a busy one. It's just, it's just kept me off the streets.
Just a little, huh? So, Swami, tell us a little bit about who you are, why this all came about, and why you traveled 3,000 miles by bus.
Well, I tell you, in my book, The New Path, which is a new book that came out, the most recent one, it tells the story of my search for truth. It's been a lifelong thing. As a child, it was more based in the question of asking why all the time, to the point where my parents were driven mad. One time on the ski slopes in Pretty Island, Romania, I called out, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy," and he fell down and got snow in his eyes and finally came up and surfaced, you might say, and I said, "Daddy, why are the church bells ringing?" I've never stopped asking why, but at the age of 13, I began actively wanting to know what life is all about, and I thought of becoming an astronomer and a scientist, and I thought, well, no, that's not going to touch my heart. I want something that will inspire me. And so then I was looking for maybe a solution through some political system, like communism, socialism, whatever ism you could come up with. And I realized that no system is going to make people. People make systems. And so that was not the answer. Then I thought maybe through the arts, through, I knew business wasn't the answer. I grew up fairly high in ESSO, Exxon as it's called now. And I just didn't want money. I remember my dad when I was 16 wanted to buy me a tuxedo, and I said, "Dad, Dad, don't bother, I'll never wear it. In fact, I'll never earn enough money to pay income tax." And that's been true all my life. I've earned a lot of money, but always for good causes, not for me. And so I began finally to realize that every single path led to the one question that I had tried to avoid, which was God. Is there a God? The churches had put me off. I didn't want that kind of God. But finally I thought, without God, there's nothing's possible. No answer can exist. And I remembered going out on a long walk and asking myself this question, if there's a God, what must he be? And I realized finally that he has to be consciousness, and that my consciousness must therefore be a part of his consciousness. And the more aware I am, the closer I am to him. And the more I turn away from him, the less aware I am. And so I decided then the only purpose of life has to be to seek God. And I thought I was going crazy because I'd never heard of anybody seeking God. I didn't know about the saints and all their lives. And I really seriously wondered if I was losing my sanity. But nothing worked. I tried to go out to the country and maybe find my inspiration in nature. That didn't work because I found that I could see beauty, but I couldn't be a part of it. I was like a machine working on one cylinder. And finally, I just decided I had to seek God. And that was when I came upon Autobiography of a Yogi in a New York bookstore. And you know, when you lift one hand up to God, he drops two to raise you up. I didn't know anything about gurus, about Indian philosophy, about anything. If my parents had been there, it would have been, I think, very difficult and probably impossible for me to make this change. But Dad had been sent to Cairo to be the petroleum investigator, oil geologist. I put my mother on the ship to go join him. The very day that I put mother on the ship was when I found Autobiography of a Yogi. And when I read that book, it absolutely changed my mind. I knew that this was the path I had to follow. I knew that this was a teacher who would help me to follow that path. I took the next bus across the country, and I came with two desires. One was to meet him, to be accepted as his disciple. The other was, this is such a wonderful teaching, I want the whole world to know about it. And both those things I've dedicated my life to, 63 years now. That was when I was 22 in 1948. I am now nearly 85, and I have not changed direction one iota ever since.
Why do you think, Swami, people have such a hard time with taking a path and following it and staying focused on it? What creates them to lose, you know, their focus or give up their ideals?
I suppose desires. I suppose disappointment because they don't get quick results. I remember this one woman saying to me, I've been doing this teaching now for 6 months and I haven't had samadhi yet. I was weeping. My goodness, it's a lifetime search. In America especially, we have that disadvantage in the American character, of restlessness. So they do tend to be fickle. They change wives, they change husbands, they change jobs, they change locations. The average American changes location, living quarters, and area where he lives 16 or more times in a lifetime. And I think that's the reason. In India, people are much more likely to remain loyal to what they dedicate themselves to.
Do you think children, Swami, should be taught at a very early age?
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, I started a whole system of schooling. It's called Education for Life, to teach children how not to just to become ready to get a good paying job, but how to be whole human beings, how to find happiness in life, how to make friends with people and stay friends and so on. And that system is becoming more and more accepted and recognized. But I think that this is the best time. The Catholics have this teaching. If you can catch a person for the first 6 years of his life, you've got him for life. I don't know if that's true, but I'd say that very definitely what you learn as a child is more likely to remain with you all your life.
And how important is it for children to meditate?
Well, you know, it's pretty difficult for children to meditate. There have to be compromises. Our children do manage to meditate, but they can't sit a long time. It's just their nature. Their hearts, I think, beat faster. And there are other ways of meditating, doing good things and thinking of God. And I don't know all the techniques we use, but one I've taught in a book that I wrote, it's a very interesting book. It's called The Time Tunnel, and I would like to talk about it more, but it's really off our subject. But anyway, in this a future time, about 1,000 years from now, there's a school that this person goes to, and the woman talks about somebody who has done something generous, and she asks the children what they think of it and so on. And he says, well, may I say something? And he said, let me talk to one of your girls, one of your students. So this little girl raises her hand, and he says, okay, now what is your favorite dessert? And she says, apple strudel. And he says, okay, now imagine that your mother has made you an apple strudel, and you go to school, and you're eager to eat this apple strudel for dessert in the hallway or wherever you eat your lunch. And then you see a boy crying. Would you know that a little piece of apple strudel would help him. Would you like to give it to him or give some of it to him? And the little girl says, gee, it would be a little difficult. And he emphasizes again, but you might make a friend of him. She says, oh, in that case, yes, of course I'd like to give up some of it. And he says, then think of it as he's very unhappy. And if you were to give him it all, would you be able to? And she says, well, gosh, But after all, I'd only enjoy the apple strudel as long as it lasted, and then it'd be gone. Whereas having him as a lifetime friend could be a wonderful blessing. And so from this, she learns the importance of generosity. Well, this kind of teaching is also what I call part of meditation. When you can learn to make your life better and to live more in tune with God, that is meditation. So it doesn't only have to be sitting there still and gazing cross-eyed or something.
Because a lot of people, not just children, have a very hard time sitting and meditating. It's like they cannot get their minds quiet. So do you have a technique through your teaching that you can kind of let the people know while they're trying to get them their minds quiet, how they can
do that? Well, I have this technique that, you know, every day that you have to brush your teeth, that your teeth need it for their own health. I said it's just as important for your own health to have peace of mind. And I don't ask you to meditate for half an hour, an hour and a half. Try 15 minutes. Try 5 minutes. I'll bargain with you. Try 2 minutes. But if you do just a little bit, you know, you get a taste for it. And once you begin to enjoy it, that's the time to increase it. So don't inflict anything on yourself, but do a little bit. And the more you do it, the more you'll enjoy it.
The book that you wrote, The Path, can you talk about it a little bit so the listeners know a little bit more about the book?
The New Path. I tell you what happened after I met Yogananda. That's the main purpose of this book. There are a lot of other lessons on the way that are worthwhile. For example, my example, that's very bad English, excuse me. But anyway, in college, I studied Greek, but I can't say I studied it. I attended classes occasionally and never did any homework. And I was fed up with college. I left college. And I really have to say that my education began after I left college. But when the professor was preparing us for the final exam, he would look at the class and say, of course, there are some people here who might as well not appear for the exam. And everybody would look at me and laugh, because I would recognize on a page maybe a word like or the, or very basic words. And I just determined I would pass it. And the week before, I picked up the book to read it, and I just couldn't. Next day, I couldn't. Third day, I'll study three times as long tomorrow. I couldn't do it. Finally, the night before the exam, suddenly I realized, oh my God, tomorrow I've got this exam, and I've got to pass it. I have no intention of failing it. I didn't know what to do. So suddenly it occurred to me that necessity is the mother of invention. I thought, well, you're a Greek. And as soon as I thought of myself as a Greek, that removed all barriers to studying Greek. And I studied that book for 2 hours intensely. And the next day, it was an unusually difficult exam. Two people passed it. I was one of them. These are things that we can learn in life, that if you want to be good at something, feel that you can do it. Open your mind to it. Don't have that resistance to it. This is true in life. This is true in the spiritual path. If you want to be a saint, don't tell yourself, I'm a sinner. Tell yourself, I am a saint. I am good. When I wanted to overcome smoking, every time I went back to smoking, which I did, I would simply say, I haven't yet succeeded. I didn't say, oh, I've failed again. This kind of consciousness is also, it permeates that book, and that's very important. But then the most important part of the book is after I meet Yogananda. It's the only book that is in existence, really, that tells what it was like to live with him, what it would be like for you to live with him, what it would have been like for you to live with him. And I think that the book is, for that reason, above everything, it's a very important book.
When people think of Swamis and gurus and people like that, a lot of people have a very hard time wondering why it is that they can stay on their path and what it is that they know that the normal everyday person who walks the street doesn't.
Well, you know, what I've tried to do in my life is show how yoga is really no different from what we all understand. I try to tie it into people's daily existence. For example, when you feel good, you walk lightly, your energy is up, you look up, you smile. When you feel down in the dumps, you feel heavy, you walk heavily, you sit with a bent spine. These are indications of things that yoga has pushed to their limit by showing that you raise the energy in the spine to attain ecstasy. You sit straight. You have a feeling of energy going upward. There's a yoga technique which says, think of the heart and think of there being a lotus in the heart turned upward with its rays going to the point between the eyebrows in the brain. There's another thing in yoga. They say that the ego is centered in the medulla oblongata, whereas your highest state, your superconscious state, is centered in the frontal lobe of the brain at the point behind between the eyebrows, or just behind that point. Well, all you have to do is point to the fact that people who are egotistical look down their noses. It shows that there's a tension in the back of their head, drawing their heads back. You can see rock singers sometimes tossing their heads back and forth. You can see that all their energy is centered in the medulla. Whereas if you can just do the simple exercise of trying to redirect that energy, not letting it be blocked in the medulla, but to move forward to the point between the eyebrows, when you can relate it to daily experience, then it becomes real for people.
They have a thing going on in New York, actually on the East Coast, more than, I think it's just now starting over here in New Mexico where I'm at. But it's called Laughing Yoga, which have you heard of that?
Yes, I have. I think it's a jolly technique. I don't know what else to say. It's, you know, laughter is still restlessness and outward. But you must have a joyful attitude in your meditation. You must have a joyful attitude in your search for truth and for God. Yogananda used to say that a saint is a sinner who never gave up. And this is a very important concept. But I would say that the laughter yoga, or whatever they call it, it's a bit trivial, but it's okay. I'm not against anything that tries to do good.
There are a lot of different forms of yoga, as there is Reiki and different modalities for healing. How does your form of yoga different than, say, maybe another person's?
Well, you know, I can't say much about it because I've never made a study. I'm not a scholar in this game. I'm a practicant. And people ask me about this saint or that saint. I really don't know. I have my path, and it's a full-time job following it. So I'm not curious. But basically, you have to say that as there are countless ways of being happy, so there must be countless ways of yoga. I'm all for it. There are many paths up a mountainside, but once you reach the peak, it's the same peak.
Yeah, that's very true. And it's just, I don't know, maybe different modalities set well with different people and what they can accept and not accept. That's also a possibility. Now, when you first started training under Yogananda, how did that feel for you? I mean, were you excited about it? Were you nervous about it? Kind of explain a little bit about how your teachings went.
Let's say that I was very full of doubts in the beginning because I had accepted him. I'd accepted the truth that he represented. I accepted everything, but my mind was far behind my heart. And for a while there, every 15 minutes, I had to sit down and just calm my mind because it was in rebellion. So, no, it was not easy, but I absolutely knew what was my path and knew that I was doing what I wanted to do. It was my mind that was rebellious. So I have to say that that's a long time ago now.
Back when you first started working with him and you started actually spreading his teachings, there's a statement on your website about in the 1950s, Yogananda gave the young disciples the task of sharing their practical teachings with people everywhere. And then the last sentence says, looming on the horizon, however, was catastrophe. What was that all about?
Would you repeat that last part? I didn't hear it well.
On the very last part, you said looming on the horizon, there was a lot of problems or a lot of trouble in the 50s. What was that about?
In which book is this?
Now, this is when you're just talking about spreading his teachings, and you're going in the 1950s when you were around and trying to share his practical teachings with people. What happened?
Oh, I had trouble with the organization. I'm no longer with them. In fact, they threw me out on my ear. That's a trivial thing. It enabled me, it freed me to do the work I really had to do. But I was trying to work within the framework of that organization, and I was much too creative for their way of thinking. But I was trying to do the things Yogananda had told me to do, and he had not told them that. That was me. And so that was the trouble, probably. I don't remember exactly, but I do know that I had a lot of difficulty that way. And I have to say, in all fairness, since I haven't given them a chance to be on this program, that they probably had trouble with me, too. I was just too gung-ho to get this teaching spread. And they didn't have that same feeling.
A lot of times, I have found when there are a lot of people doing their teaching, sometimes some people's egos tend to get in the way, and that would create somebody who's really trying to follow the path. It would make it very hard for them.
I'm sure it did. And they accused me of ego, but I was trying to do what he had told me to do. You just can't play that game forever. I don't even think about it now. I don't really feel that I exist. I feel that I'm just doing what he wanted, and my greatest goal in life is to get rid of this ego, to understand that it's God who does everything. But he had a particular song to play through me, and I've done my best to do that. I'm not going to worry about judging other people.
No, that doesn't work really well. Now, you've also done some spiritual communities. Let's talk a little bit about those.
Yes, you know, this was something that was, perhaps I was born to do, I don't know, because at the age of 15 I was thinking of starting communities, but I was too young to start them at that age. And when I found this was one of his ideals, and very much one of his ideals, then I wanted very much to help this ideal along. And I asked the president of the organization, when are we going to start them? And her answer was, frankly, I'm not interested. Well, when they threw me out, this became my opportunity. I figured if they aren't interested, it won't be in conflict with anybody if I start a community. So in 1967, I got the land and actually began the community on July 4th, 1969, Independence Day. So we were declaring a new kind of independence. And now we're in our 42nd or 43rd year of existence, and we pretty well proved that this system does work. And I'm very eager for it because I believe that it will be the salvation of many people during what I consider to be a future of very hard economic times.
It's going to be very hard. In the communities, how many are there?
We have in our 8 communities, it says 7, it's 8 really, we have about 1,000 people living.
And where are the communities located?
Well, let's see, there are 2 in India, 1 in Italy, 1 in Nevada City, 1 in Sacramento, 1 in Palo Alto, 1 in Portland, 1 in Seattle. I think that's all. I may have overlooked something, but I don't think so.
So you have a lot of the communities here in the United States.
Most of them are here. That's where I am, after all. But I kept being invited to Italy for various reasons. And I thought, why? Because Yogananda told me maybe he would send me to Europe someday. And I thought, why are they bringing me to Italy? I know Romanian, I know French, I know German, I know Spanish. Italy, I didn't know Italian. And but they kept inviting me there, so finally I ended up being in Italy. And I remember a funny episode that forced me to finally decide I had to learn this blessed language. So anyway, I learned it. Now I speak it pretty well. People think I am Italian many times. And then in India, we started one in Gurgaon, which is outside New Delhi. I remember many years ago in India, I had wanted to get some place there, and they told me about Gurgaon. But then it wasn't built up enough. It was just a little village. Now it's a pretty sophisticated area. So we have one community there, and we're developing a community on 130 acres or something of land near Pune in the south of India. And we have quite a few land, quite a few people building land there. Any Indians listening to this program, I hope that you will look into helping that community grow, because it will be a great help for the future. These communities, I believe, are only the beginning of a wave of communities that will sweep the world, because I think this is the most sane way of living, not in cities, but living in small communities of like-minded souls.
Is there anything special that a person would have to do in order to be able to come to one of the communities?
Well, anybody can come. He's welcome to come. We have retreat facilities where people come for a day, a week, a month. But if you want to join the community, then you can find your further steps from there. We do ask people to belong to our path, because I found that people on different paths, if they're too close together, supposing we all believe in reincarnation. Suppose somebody's rapidly against reincarnation. It would be a pain in the neck to have to always, in his presence, tone down your conversation about past lives, you know? So It's good for people all to be following one path. But beyond that, basically we have two rules. One is people are more important than things. And things include projects and even things that are important to the community. If there's nobody whom it can help in doing it, then we simply drop the project. And the other one is based on a Sanskrit saying, yata dharma stata jaya, which is where there is right action, there is victory, success, happiness, and all good things. So these are the two rules that we've followed, and we follow them rigidly. I know back in 1976, we had a forest fire which destroyed 450 of our 750 acres. And our neighbors discovered that the fault was a faulty spark arrestor on a county vehicle. So they gleefully were saying, we can sue the county. And they did sue, and they collected. But I wrote to the supervisors, and I said, I know you're most worried about us because we're the biggest losers. I want you to know that we will not be taking out our bad luck on our neighbors. We will not sue you. We didn't have any fire insurance. That's what I mean by right action. We were happy all the time, and our neighbors were still suffering after 10 years. So we believe very strongly, if you act rightly, everything will go right.
Well, which is basically true, but I don't think a lot of people understand that today, because if you take a look around the world, you're seeing many, many things that really should not be going on, and yet many people stand by and allow it.
No, I don't bother with me trying to make sense to people. I'm not trying to persuade anybody. I tell people, this is what we do, and it works for us. Try it yourself and see if it'll work for you. But I would waste a lot of time trying to persuade the whole world that I'm right and they're wrong. It's their business.
It would never work anyway. Let's talk a little bit about the Royal Yoga. What is that?
The Royal Yoga is essentially, you see, there are different yogas. One is, well, you know Hatha Yoga, of course, that's the physical branch of Raja Yoga. But Bhakti Yoga, which is the yoga of devotion, Jnana Yoga, which is the yoga of discrimination and wisdom, Karma Yoga, which is the yoga of action, these are bypassed because the final, for example, when you become deeply immersed in Bhakti Yoga, you stop being able even to practice anything. You stop being able to sing, chant, and so on. You become immersed in God. When you practice Wisdom Yoga, Jnana Yoga, you go beyond discrimination to knowing. And so the Raja Yoga is the royal pathway on which all these tributary rivers meet. And that one royal path is the spine. And Raja Yoga particularly concentrates on raising the energy up through the spine and directing it to the point between the eyebrows.
Which, again, is real important because I don't know if people quite know how to do that. You've also written a few short books, and you have one that's called Do It Now, which I think is kind of
interesting. You know, I've got a more recent one than that, and this is even better, Living Wisely, Living Well. It's just come out, and I have to say I'm very pleased with this one. It debuts on January 16. Yeah, I've asked my friend here to find one today's reading for it. Okay. Here's today's reading. Cultivate the art of brevity. A single well-phrased sentence will be long remembered, whereas long discourses are usually soon forgotten. In writing this book, too, I have tried to make every sentence as short and concise as possible. Meandering sentences often lose themselves like country paths in the unkempt grass of tangled thinking. So this is just one day out of 365 or 6, if you want to take leap year into account. And Do It Now is the same, but much more brief. Actually, I wrote Do It Now all in one day. And that was a bit of a feat, but I was afraid I'd forget something if I didn't keep up the whole sequence. So I ended around 3 a.m.
Well, that book was pretty good book, because you actually
paid. Yeah, I liked it very well. You know, I liked it so much that when I first finished it, I, from my own money, printed 5,000 copies and gave them away.
Which I think is pretty impressive. A lot of people need to have a book like this. How often each day should they read, you know, say that phrase? Should they read it more than once a day or just once and then put it down?
It's up to them. You can read out of sequence. No alarms will sound. The police won't bang on your door.
They're not. Why not? Let's talk a little bit about your music, because I know that you also, like I told earlier, did 400 songs. What is your music about?
Actually, it's 400 songs. May I sing one of them to you right now?
Sure.
Though green summer fade and winter draw near, my Lord, in your presence I live without fear. Through tempest, through snows, through turbulent tide, the touch of your hand is my strength and my guide. I ask for no riches that death can destroy. I crave only thee, your love and your joy. The dances will pass, the singing must end. I welcome the darkness with you for my friend.
That's pretty good. Now, a lot of your songs, are they mostly message songs, inspirational songs?
They're all of them inspirational, but not all of them say serious. I've written funny songs. I've written playful songs. I wrote a non-blues. many different kinds. But The ones that have meant the most to me are the inspiring ones. And all of them have a message that is uplifting.
Which I think is real important considering what's going on again with today's world.
Yeah.
Now, do you go and visit the villages, the communities?
I do. But mind you, I'm nearly 85 and I can't do much traveling. So right now I'm in Los Angeles to complete, I've written a couple of scripts for movies and these are being made into movies. So I'm down here helping to get them going. I'll have to act in them too. And, of course, my headquarters is in Ananda Village near Nevada City, which I began first. But also in Italy, also in India. And my traveling days are somewhat limited now. It takes a lot of energy to travel.
No, I'm sure it does. In the communities, are there houses? Are there, you know, one-room buildings? What are they?
Are there what?
For the houses that the people are in, for the communities?
They have their own homes. Now, it's not a big dormitory. People build their own homes, and I don't know if there are many who live more than one in a home. They're mostly their own homes. And they're built according to their own style. But, of course, we have to pass on that style to some extent. We wouldn't want somebody building a shack, for example.
No, that would not work. Now, are you going... Now, I know you just got done saying that right now you're in California and you're doing some movies, but are you still planning on doing, you know, traveling with upcoming talks?
Well, you know, radio is such a wonderful medium. I mean, being on this show, I don't have to go anywhere. Right now I'm in Hawaii resting, and still I can do that show. So I think this is a wonderful medium. And I will go back to the village. We have a big tulip festival there. At least 4,000 people will be coming from all over at in my own garden. You know, when my father died, my parents died, they left me a certain amount of money. And I thought, well, my dad had never given a dime to Ananda. I didn't want to make his soul suffer by giving the money to Ananda, but I didn't want to keep it. So my solution was to build a home for myself, which would satisfy him, but let it be the spiritual center for our whole community. So this home is called Crystal Hermitage, and we have a chapel on the grounds where many people come to get married, and we have a beautiful garden. And this tulip festival is because we planted about 5,000 tulips there, and people come from all over to love. It's a beautiful place. I'll be going back there because it'll be the first time ever that I've been able to go to this tulip festival. I've had to be in Italy and India and elsewhere, but I'm really looking forward to it now.
And when is the date of that again?
It'll be, I don't know the actual dates, but you could look up ananda.org or anandala.org, and it'll be in April. I'm not sure of the exact weekends.
Now, do you only have the tulip fest at that one place, or is it at all?
No, this is the garden where we have them.
So it's
and really, it is just about as beautiful as that one in Hoogeveen or whatever it is in Holland. It just is really beautiful. So I do urge everybody to come. I think they'll be inspired.
Well, I think tulips are pretty anyway. So, I mean, most people should go and give out the website where they can find it at, also where they can find your books, and even get in contact with you.
Yes.
Yes, for ananda.org.
Ananda.org, is that right? Yes, ananda.org. A-N-A-N-D-A. That's the Sanskrit word meaning bliss or joy.
And that tells about the Tulip Fest?
It'll tell you about that, too.
Okay, because I'm sure people would really probably like to check out some of your communities and learn more about you. If they want to get your books, where can they get them?
Well, they can always go to any bookstore in their area. They usually find some there and a list of them, but they can also write at ananda.org for that. They're published by Crystal Clarity, but that is a company I founded, and its center is at also in the village there, at Ananda Village.
Why did you choose Yoganandi instead of maybe choosing somebody else? What brought you to him rather than a different person?
Well, I think I've answered that pretty well, Nancy. I had never heard of anybody but him. I wasn't looking for a guru. I knew that I needed help, but I didn't know where I'd get it. I'd never met anybody who showed the kind of wisdom I wanted, and I didn't know that kind of wisdom existed. But when I read his book, Autobiography of a Yogi, I knew, and I knew this was the man for me, and there was no... I never had to seek anywhere else. I've had that good fortune that as soon as I wanted it, it came to me, and I've been going that way ever since.
Do people accept your teachings easily at this point?
You know, my particular skill, if you want to say that I have a skill, is somehow making them acceptable and believable. So many people have come through me, many, countless thousands. And it's because I make them down to earth. I can relate them to their own lives. And I do my best not to make it sound esoteric and difficult and so on. I try to honor their reality when speaking. And I never talk to people. I never lecture to people. I only share with them what little I know.
But it sounds like to me you know a lot.
Well, whatever it is, I share with them. I don't dictate. I'm not didactic.
A lot of times it doesn't work to dictate. People will tend to get tired of that and they'll leave. Or
nobody likes that.
No, not at all.
You know, what I try to share with them, more than the words even, is my vibration. I feel a lot of bliss in myself, and I try to share that bliss with them. And I guess it rubs off on a few people. I hope so.
Oh, I'm sure it's going to. If it hasn't yet, I'm sure it will. A lot of your teachings with Yogananda, because you were with him for a very long time. When he...
I wasn't with him a long time. I was with him 3.5 years. But then I console myself that the disciples of Jesus were with him less time than that.
So when he passed...
Yeah. I was present on that occasion.
Okay. And how did that affect you, if at all?
Oh, it affected me terribly. I mean, it's like losing your own mother. And I was very sad, but now is the time that I must spread this teaching which I've received from him. I'm so grateful to him for what he's given me. I want everybody to know about it. And so it was not a negative experience in the sense of discouraging. It was sort of a firing up experience in the sense of giving the incentive to go out and get the word out. And that word I've always said to people, I'm not trying to convert you to anything except your own higher self.
People sometimes have a very hard time believing that they have a higher self, and they would rather stay as a victim or in fear. What can
you... I'm not a psychologist, and I'm not there to hold their hands. I'm for people. I can help people who want to walk on their own 2 feet. I always say the most important yoga posture is being able to stand on your own 2 feet. So I'm not a doctor, but I'm there to help people, I hope, who are ready to be inspired.
For some of your meditations, are they made for special reasons, or is the meditation that you do for everything?
They're for everybody. You can always turn them to special reasons. For example, when I write music, I never think through what notes I want. I say that I want a song that says such, such, and such, and such, and such. Then I offer those thoughts up to the superconscious, And immediately the answer comes, the melody comes, sometimes even the chords and everything. So this is something that is a meditative state in a sense, because I ask God to show me how to write, what to write in a song, and then the words just flow. I know one time I was feeling sort of, it was so much work thinking up good lyrics and having a rhyme and so on. So I thought, well, let me just write melodies for Shakespeare's lyrics, because I love Shakespeare. And in 18 days, I wrote 18 songs. Well, that's how quickly they come to me, just in an instant. And this is meditation. I remember Yogananda one time meditating. He was a very good cook, and he brought us a meal. He said, when I cook, I don't taste with my tongue. I taste it in the spiritual eye, and I can tell the taste there. So mind you, these techniques of meditation put you in tune with your intuition, and your intuition is your true meditation. And that you can do walking, you can do cooking, you can do writing music, you can do trying to make money. I remember East West Bookstore, it was in Menlo Park at that time, now it's in Mountain View. But when Mrs. Sharfman, Virginia Sharfman, first asked me many years ago if I wanted to buy it for Ananda, and I didn't know, but I brought my mind to the point between the eyebrows and asked. Instantly, I knew I should buy it. We didn't have the money to buy it, but the money came within the time needed, which was 2 weeks, and we needed $40,000, but somebody gave us $36,000, and somebody else got some more money. And anyway, everything worked out. So I found that meditation, applied in a practical way, is perhaps the most sure key to success. And that's why this course that I'm giving in February is an important course, because it helps people to know how to achieve success and happiness in their daily lives through right action, how to attract what you need when you need it, inspiration, how to work for inspiration, the importance of right attitude, what is it to be practical, first things first. All these things are very important. But finally, it's meditation, or the application of meditation principles, that helps you to succeed at anything that you want to do.
That sounds really, really very good. Now, if they want to find out more about that, give them your
website
again. They can
write to anandala.org. A-N-A-N-L-A for Los Angeles, .org.
And so if they go there, they can sign up?
Yeah.
And it's February the what?
February the 1st is the first class, and I'll be giving it.
Okay. And is it going to be here in the United States?
In Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles, because that's the LA.
Yeah.
The other thing with your music, you have one that has chants on it.
Has a chant?
It has chants. Yes,
which chant do you mean? I've had many chants.
Well, this one
Do you have one?
On the one that I'm looking at is the chants of Yogananda. And on
Door of My Heart, is that the one?
Yes.
Is that it?
Yes.
Door of my heart, open wide I keep for thee. Door of my heart, open wide I keep for thee. Wilt thou come? Wilt thou come? Just for once come to me. Will my days fly away without seeing thee, my Lord? Night and day, I look for thee night and day. Yogananda used to say that chanting is half the battle. You know, more than people understand, their heart is what tells them the truth, not their reason. And chanting helps you to be in tune with your feeling nature, your higher feeling nature.
And I think that's important. A lot of people, one, don't chant. They don't even sing, nor do they hum. So if they could just do any of those three, I think it would help to put their physical, emotional, and mental state back into balance.
You're absolutely right.
You know, so, and it doesn't have to necessarily be any one particular song. They could just hum something that, you know, they made up in their own head. Just even hum it.
Yeah. I used to chant sometimes hours on end, and it helped enormously.
How important, in your opinion, do you think it is for people to do mantras?
Mantras are helpful. They're a lower kind of meditation as a rule, but they certainly help. You know, some of these mantras are a bit complex. Gayatri mantra, I'll sing it to you, because this is the main mantra of the Vedas. Om Bhur Bhuva Swaha, Om Tat Savitur Varaniyam Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi Dhiyo Yo Naha Prachodayat Om. This is a very powerful mantra, but it's more important to become these things than to chant them. Still, the vibrations of the chant help to tune your whole system, and it's very good. I'd say that the direct practice of Raja Yoga, the mantra yoga, is another sidetrack, you might say, or a side path, I should say. But Raja Yoga, through the breath and the connection of the breath with the mind and bringing the energy into the spine, this is the most direct. Still, we too practice. Also, we practice japa, singing to God all day long. It's very important. It helps to crowd out of your mind all other thoughts. So keep your mind on God, and just even something English like, come to me, reveal thyself, reveal thyself. These things are very important.
Is a mantra the same as a positive affirmation?
No, it's not. It's similar. But a positive affirmation is, I want to this, or I am this, or whatever. These mantras are usually involve the name of God. It would take me a while to try to explain it, but basically they're different in that they aren't affirmations. They're repeating the names of God to put yourself in tune with the higher vibrations of sound that have been evolved over the centuries in India that will put you in tune with your own higher self.
Do you think everybody has a sense of intuition, whether they use it or not?
Everybody has it latently, but many reason is what crowds out intuition more than anything else. I know I was just telling a friend of mine today that my mother used to say after a letter would come, well, I knew it would come. And she said one day to my father, because he was always saying, well, you're always saying it after the fact. He was a complete skeptic. So he said, all right, today I tell you, such and such a letter will be coming today. And it did come. But women are also often much more intuitive than men, because they go more by feeling, and intuition is a feeling thing. Men go too much by reason, and reason can make a lot of sense, but you can be wrong with reason. You can be devilishly ingenious and damnably wrong, you could say.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's real important that people understand that they do have that ability, and they have to trust it and try using it to keep
it's
themselves.
It's native to everybody.
And
you need to develop it. And that's what I respect in what you're doing, that you're helping people to understand their own intuition and to use it. And I believe in that. I congratulate you.
And I thank you. Before we run out of time, because we're almost out of time, give out your website to the people again, please.
Well, the website in Los Angeles is Ananda, A-N-A-N-D-A-L-A, for Los Angeles, .org. And for Ananda as a whole, A-N-A-N-D-A again, .org, without the L-A.
And you also have one that has your name in it, too.
What is that?
You also have a website that people can find you at that's by your name.
This, I think so, but I'm
one of
my secretaries telling me yes.
Yes, you do. You might want to give that one out, too, but you will have to spell your last name.
Tell me. SwamiKriyananda.org. SwamiKriyananda.org. Mind you, I'm an old man, and all this newfangled stuff like the Internet is just beyond me.
I know. Me, too. Computers and I don't get along very well. But spell the last name so that people want to look at it.
K-R-I-Y-A Kriya Nanda. Kriya Ananda it is, but it's only one A in the middle. Kriya Ananda. And Swami S-W-A-M-I.
Okay, because there's a lot of information on all of those, because I looked at all of them, so I know.
Good, very good for you.
Anyway, Swami, our time is up. It has been great listening to you and talking with you. I'm sure the listeners enjoyed it just as well. And good luck.
I've enjoyed it too.
Good. And good luck with your upcoming, you know, thing you're having in February and the Tulip Fest and everything. So good luck with all of that. And thank you for being on the show. You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. I'd like to thank you, the listeners. May God bless all of you. Have a great week, and we'll talk later. Take care. Bye now.